I thought maybe we could take a little bit of time and maybe, particularly if you have questions about the session I did, or Pastor Keith's back in the back, he could probably answer questions as well. Yes, sir. Your first name.
Hi.
Okay.
In your session, you mentioned how the tone when engaging society needs to change compared to how the tone has been in the past. Do you mind fleshing that out a little bit about how we engage people, especially in the secular, like in the secular workplace or in secular settings, when we interact with homosexual or transgender people?
Yeah.
To follow up, you had addressed how to handle that when somebody comes to your church. But how do you address that in the workplace where you're on a different ground there?
I think that in part, your generation's already doing it. When I was coming up, we were really strong on the truth component and really light on the compassion component. And so if you were someone that was in that lifestyle and you were trapped in that sin, you could almost feel like there was absolutely no hope for you. Particularly if you felt like, I didn't choose this. When somebody would get up and really go strong at your homosexuality is a choice, and you're sitting there going, if there were any way I could choose not to have this, I would do it. You sort of put people in a category that they had no way to deal with. And so really coming to look at it from a biblical perspective, and part of you know, I'm just looking at, you know, kind of the world I grew up in, we didn't have the theologians who had done nearly the amount of thinking on this topic that has been done. So I think, you know, there were some resources I meant to tell you back. Let me find the page. On page 13, What the Bible Really Teaches About Homosexuality, Kevin DeYoung's book. In my opinion, if you want to see what truth and tone look like in the context of what I'm talking about, he does a really good job with that. Of just being really straight up about the truth, but at the same time being very, very compassionate and very respectful of a fellow image bearer. And I think probably in my generation, we tended to look at people like this and we didn't respect them as humans. There was... You know, the kind of terminology that we used, the sort of the derogatory approach we had. And so I think Kevin DeYoung does a very good job when he talks about that way. The book at the bottom, What is the Meaning of Sex? Is a superb resource by Denny Burke. He's probably the guy, and I'm just going to... There's another book he wrote, and I want to mention it to you. It's called Transforming Homosexuality. And the reason I'm bringing those books up in a transgender conversation is a lot of the same sort of language and terminology, you know, floats between those discussions. So Denny Burke is at Southern Seminary. He's probably the person right now that has done the most writing and the most thinking about these issues. And he has a blog that you can go on, and it's got all kinds of posts on it that are very, very brief and very, very helpful. So that's what I would say about the tone question. Good question. What's your first name?
My name is Josh.
Josh, okay.
You had made a comment about image bearers, how God wanted to populate the earth with image bearers, so the universe can see his glory. How is that not a selfish act?
When you're God, it's not. When you're not, it is. I mean, I know that sounds like a really sort of simplistic, shut the question down kind of answer. But if you walk that question all the way back, and I'm not saying you're doing this, okay? So, but this is sort of the kind of question that Paul is talking about in Romans when he says to the person who's sort of raising that challenge to God, who are you to ask God that kind of a question? And I'm not directing that question to you. I'm just saying that when that question typically comes up, we tend to be viewing God through our lens, and we can't imagine how expecting everybody to just worship us is a good thing. But that is, in essence, what idolatry is. It is self-worship. When you're humans created in the image of the ultimate being in the universe. Part of the definition of God is you are the recipient of worship. You are the only legitimate recipient of worship. That's part of what it means to be God. So, you know, it's a simplistic answer, but in many ways it's the most profound answer you can get. Because all other answers are pretty much sort of making God just a little bigger and better than us, but assigning to him the same sort of moral and motives that we have, and assigning, you know, if the essence of ego and the essence of pride is wanting to be like who? God. But it's not pride when you're God. So you know, it's the same kind of a question or of an answer. So, very good question. Yes, ma'am.
When you're discipling a new Christian who just recently got saved and was living a transgender or homosexual lifestyle, at what point do you address that in that discipleship?
I think that it's going to come out fairly early in the conversation. And, you know, there, in most conversations I've had, it has surfaced on its own. You know, you're having conversations about God, you're having conversations about the Word, you're having conversations that are coming out of a very different worldview when it comes to morality. And sooner or later, there's going to be these foundational incompatibilities that are going to show up. And so, you know, to me, that's kind of where the truth intersects with life. And it's sort of like, well, you say you love God. There's a part of your life I'm not really sure how that works. Can you help me reconcile what you're doing here with what you say you feel toward God? And yet, you know, here's what God said about loving him. If you love me, keep my commandments. So I'm not understanding how these parts work in your life very well. And sooner or later, and probably sooner than later, those become fairly evident. Sometimes people, at least in the context I'm in, struggle with it, and they're not going to surface it. Especially on a campus like a Bob Jones University. I am not going to surface this. But it is who I am. I mean, What's happening more and more now to the students I'm talking to, authenticity matters a great deal to them. And it really comes to the place where authenticity matters even more than security. I mean, you're wanting security and you're wanting authenticity. And while if you can have both, you want both. And generally, security is going to trump authenticity, but more and more authenticity is coming to the forefront. That's anecdotal. I don't know that I can support that, but you know that tends to surface fairly quickly. It's become much more, I think part of the reason that it's coming to the surface much more quickly is it's becoming much more normalized. You know, it's no longer in the general public. It's no longer stigmatized like it used to be. It's now sort of, you know, you must be really brave to have to, you know, go through that, and you know, all of a sudden it's normalized, and so people talk about it much more openly than they've ever done. You know, coming out of the closet no longer means coming out of the closet in the way that it used to mean. It just means I'm going to tell the world who I really am, and I got to figure out how to do that in ways that don't blow up my relationships. You know, or at least minimize the damage to them. But it's no longer the shame factor that it used to be. Although people who are going through that experience will tell you, no matter how accepted it is in the culture, I'm always going to feel different. So fairly early, I would think. Yes, sir.
You know, it might be cold or a little bit harsh to tell them it's just a choice. It might be cold or harsh to tell them it's a choice they've made, but at some point in time in our discipleship, will we have to, tell them to make choices? Right.
And I'm sorry I wasn't more clear about this. The act of homosexuality, the homosexual acts are definitely choices. But some of the orientation may not be. So same-sex attraction is not the same thing as same-sex sexual activity. It can lead to that. And so when I talk about, when we talk about homosexual, the term that we were using back when I was coming up typically referred to a person who engaged in that lifestyle. When you use that term today, you're talking about a person whose identity is that. This is how I am oriented. This is who I am, whether I act on it or not. And I didn't choose this. My personal story would be I didn't choose to be male. I didn't choose to be heterosexual. That is who I am. And I happen to have attractions that go with that. So here's a person who didn't choose to be male, but he has attractions that don't go with that. And so what does that person do? I think that's where somebody coming along in that lifestyle is saying, I'm in the lifestyle because I had nowhere else to go. Because when I came to you, you told me I was unredeemable. And that it was a choice. I didn't feel like I had a choice about this. I would give anything to be like you. And so coming to nuance that a little more theologically in line with what we read in Scripture, I think has been very helpful to that discussion. Yes, ma'am.
You talked about gender identity in light of God's purposes for gender and for sexual identity. In light of that, what do you do with people who identify themselves on what they call the asexual spectrum? Androgynous, that kind of thing.
And again, I'm going to come back to, there are obviously people who are in a medical category that we all acknowledge are complicated. And just like we would have physical abnormalities in our, so we're talking about the general population and you have, and that is a growing trend, by the way, the asexual. I would come back to the very same things we've talked about and talk about the fact that God created gender, and when he created it, he did not create a third one. He created two distinct genders, and he blessed the union of those two genders. And so an odd gender is not a category that God created. And an asexuality, I mean, the idea of being celibate does not mean that you're asexual. Your sexuality is who you are as a person. You know, how you use that and how you submit that drive to God is part of your sanctification, which is what I want to talk about here in just a few minutes. But the idea that if I'm never going to be married, I should not have any kind of sexuality, and this drive isn't really good. That's actually looking at something God created and saying, this should not be a part of my life because it's hard to control. Did you see what I'm saying? So submitting that to God and really bringing that to God is part of my reasonable service to him in Romans 12, which means I got to think entirely different about it than the current culture thinks about it. So I don't get to use my sexuality any way that I want to. I don't get to use yours any way that I want to. Do you see what I'm saying? So, but the idea that, I'm in this third category, there are people whose bodily traits and mannerisms can be more you know, more on a spectrum, but there's a clearly identified gender and there's a clearly identified sexual orientation that should go with that. So, I'm trying to give you a simplistic answer. Yes, ma'am.
How would I address homosexual Christians who are not just dealing with the emotions or whatever, but they're actually living with other male or females and going to church and worshiping God and saying that He has like a big part in their life and that God's blessed them and they know that their lifestyle is okay because of all the blessings from God, and they have reasons, like biblical sounding reasons, to address the passages in the Bible that talk about God's judgment on homosexuality, and like they have all these reasons.
Yeah,
and
that's a great question. What's your first name?
Lisa.
So I'm going to ask you a question. It's not intended to be a poking one. Okay. How would you address an adulterous Christian who went to church with the person he was committing adultery with, his wife that he's still married to, lives in another town, but he is fully living in this lifestyle, and he claims that this is loving and God's blessing them, and other believers are just really celebrating it and thinking about how loving our church is, because, you know, how would we handle that?
Honestly, I'm not sure. I have friends like that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, right.
It's hard.
So we don't necessarily have an example of the one that you asked about, the homosexual, but we actually have that very same situation in 1 Corinthians 5. Mm-hmm. So in 1 Corinthians 5, there is a man that's coming to the Corinthian church. He's part of that church. He's not an outsider. He's a member of that church. And he is living in open sexual sin with someone who's not his wife. In fact, she's somebody else's wife. And the person that she is the wife of is his father. And the church is just celebrating this. They are so proud of their love. The Apostle Paul comes right up to that whole scenario and says, "This cannot. I told you this couldn't keep going. Cannot allow this. You were to put this man out of the church." So you may not be in a position to put somebody out of the church as a member, but that tells you sort of the tone. I'm not talking that you go in swinging bats, but the tone, you know, we don't celebrate this. This is not okay. It should not be going on in our church. And if it is, there's a huge problem here that is much, much bigger than, "I don't like the carpet and I wish the music were different." And, you know, this is a huge moral betrayal of the gospel. And we have precise instructions about how to handle it. Now, Paul's going to say to that person who gets put out of the church, he's still a brother. It's going to change your fellowship with him if he persists in this sin. But you treat him as a brother. He's not an outsider. You know, you don't get to be disrespectful. But you don't get to just go on having a relationship as though we just have a minor difference of opinion here. There's a huge breach in the body that has happened because of your sin. Now, this is a willful sin that he's not struggling with. It's one thing if somebody is falling into sin, repenting of that sin, struggling against that sin, I'm going to handle that very differently than I am going to handle somebody who's going, "This is great. This is what God wants for me. I'm going to do it." And at that point, I'm going to say to that person, "I'm not God in your life, but this is not something that can happen in the church. And it's going to affect our relationship. I love you as a brother or a sister, but we can't have the kind of fellowship that would imply that there's nothing going on in your life that's contrary to the scriptures in a major way." This is not a difference of opinion here. Does it make sense?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Anything else? Yes, sir.
I was just going to add that 1 Corinthians passage. That's the passage where it actually does say that if they're a professing brother, and engage in sexual immorality with such a one not even being.
Right.
So what would that look like if I'm working with a professing believer and they're not a member of my church, but they go to another church?
Right. At the very least, what Paul is saying, because that's a very debated passage about the eating part. At the very least, Paul is talking about the communion table at the church. Because you got to remember, they didn't do communion like we do communion. We do it on the Sunday night, you know, in the middle of a service, at the end of a service. For them, it was a meal, a full-blown meal. But they would get together and celebrate together. And Paul is saying, with this kind of a brother, do not do that. He's not invited to the table when he's in this kind of sin. So at the very least, it means that. And I would argue that that's the more serious meal. That's absolutely the most serious meal that we have as believers. We don't typically think of what meals implied, breaking bread, you know, eating together in an Eastern culture was implied a whole lot of things. This is a serious breach. In other words, not eating together doesn't mean that you don't have some meaningful interchange. It's indicating that there is a major breach in the way your relationship happens. It doesn't mean that if that person comes and you happen to be eating lunch at the same restaurant that you get up and leave. You know, it doesn't mean that if you've got a 14-year-old son in your home who's a minor, who is rebellious and he's doing things that you don't feed him at your house. You know, this is talking about two adult people who are in membership at a body, and it has to do with how you receive those people and what you do with those people. And it's talking about a major shift in your relationship. You know, it doesn't mean I'm rude to you. It doesn't mean I'm ugly to you. I'm entreating you. I'm beseeching you. I'm begging you. I'm praying for you. I'm overcoming your evil with my good. Doesn't mean I can't be kind to you. Doesn't mean I can't be nice to you. But it does mean that there is a serious breach in our fellowship. And however we communicate that, why don't you invite me over anymore? We always used to do things. Well, there's a serious breach here. Doesn't mean I can't necessarily, you know, ever do anything with you, but you need to understand, life cannot go on the way it was. Life cannot go on the way it was. So, you know, what it means for a city with 50 churches is a little different than what it meant for a New Testament city that had one church, maybe had house churches out of that one church. You know, the application of it may look a little differently, but the spirit of it is the same. If there's a major breach, and you're part of the body of Christ, there ought to be some recognition of that. By the way, in my opinion, this is why church membership is so important. And we live in a day and age where nobody wants to join anything. But I think it's incredibly significant. All right, how about one more question? Yes, ma'am. Two more.
I have a friend, and this friend has been struggling for quite a few years with her sexual orientation, and she has decided a year ago to go the same-sex aisle, and she has recently gotten engaged to that same-sex person. And she asked me not only to go to her wedding, but to be part of that wedding. And my desire is to say no. I have two desires. I want to go, and then there's my logical sense where it's spiritual, and it's no. But I don't know how to say no to her without having, I don't know the biblical sense. I don't know the biblical answer to it.
Well, I think what's really commendable in you is this desire and this love. So obviously this person means something to you.
Yes.
And the gospel travels best down the road of a relationship. And so I think that component's very, very clear. I'm going to go back to my question that I asked earlier.
Okay.
You know, it's a hard question, and it's not, I don't mean it to be a smarty alecky type question. But what would you do if you had a friend who was married and decided to leave their spouse, was not divorced, committing adultery, and they want you to come to a sort of a celebration of this new union?
I couldn't be a part of it.
You couldn't be a part of it. Why?
Because it's biblically wrong.
Okay. So how is that different than this? You have a massively moral breach happening here. Massive moral breach happening, just like here. You have no questions about this one, but you have questions about this one. So how is the biblical authority different here than here?
There isn't,
and that's how I would come at it. Remember what I said? We have to go past the scriptures being a sacred text to actually being really authoritative and really hard spots for us. Now, how you communicate that to her is going to be important as well. Why can't I do this thing that I, because I have deep love for you, but I have a deeper commitment and a deeper love for the God that both you and I claim to know, and I can't be a part of this. And there are all kinds of scriptures that lead to that, right? I mean, we could easily go to scriptures that forbid us from having any kind of active involvement in that, in supporting those kinds of things.
I don't want those scriptures to.
Well, that's where I think really coming to things like this is super helpful. And we're going to talk about sanctification here in just a minute, I think.
Sorry.
No, this is why we're doing this. But this is where, okay, so you know you don't know scriptures in this way. This is where I think a really good, and all of us need to be transparent about the things we don't know, right? I mean, we should all be transparent. So find a good study Bible. That is a huge piece. There are, you know, wonderful study Bibles. I love the MacArthur Study Bible. The ESV Study Bible is another really great study Bible that are out there. And just start looking through topics like this. So what should my relationship to sin be? Because sin usually happens through people. You know, sin doesn't show up disembodied. Sin usually occurs because somebody did it. So it says, have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness. The unfruitful works of darkness don't just show up like in anybody. Unfruitful works of darkness here. It shows up in a person who's doing them. So I can't participate in them, but I'm to have nothing to do with them. So this is going to have implications now for things like what you're talking about. Make sense?
Yes.
I tell you, a great place to start for those kind of questions, Paul's short letters. Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, and Colossians all speak to different aspects of this. All right, I saw one more, and then I'll take 10 minutes.
Coming off of the question over here with someone who professes to be a believer in church and openly involved in a homosexual relationship, right. At what point is it biblical and appropriate, based on 1 Corinthians 6, 9 and 10, what Paul addresses later on, to say, if you do this, and because we said, you know, they're still our brother or sister, if you continue in this, at what point is it appropriate to say, you are not saved? And I know probably need to be careful on that, but is that a appropriate view of that verse?
Yeah, I'm coming back to the whole reason you church discipline. You don't church discipline unsaved people. Right? So you discipline out of your church people who proclaim and profess to be believers. So if somebody says to me, you're right, I'm not saved. Well, that, you know, I know you joined our church 6 years ago, but if you're really not saved, we have a regenerated church membership, you're not in it by your own profession. Mm. But if you claim to be saved, I have to treat you by your confession, because you are living like a what? You're living like a pagan. So either you're a pagan who thinks you're a Christian, or you're a Christian who's living like a pagan. either way, you can't be in this assembly as a member in good standing. So now what do I do with this person who says, well, okay, he kicked me out, but I'm still a Christian? I'm going to say to him, you know, I'm going to tell you to do what Paul did. You need to examine yourself to see whether you really are in the faith. Because what you're doing is so fundamentally incompatible with what the Spirit of God should be doing in your life. So I'm going to treat you like a willfully disobedient and persistently sinful brother. And I can't, you know. Mm-hmm. I can do things with pagans that I'm not going to do with you. So, does that make sense?
Yeah.